This is Talk Is Cheap on KBWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. All right, part two of Family Abolition. But we had a... luckily, the students, they said they were going to come and arrest them this week. But a bunch of people from the community showed up for a rally and stopped that from happening. So in the future, I'll be playing audio from that. But today, I went to the vigil that happened that evening, which was Tuesday evening, and recorded some stuff from that. So I have time to play you the poem that was read by the pro-divestment person there. And... you know, just as an aside, I've been researching this. I just read the University of Nike and their whole argument. They're saying the university is claiming that the donors don't want them to divest from Israel and war and things like that. And, you know, universities, they used to just put their money in the bank. And think about it. What if they just put their money in credit unions? Now, they have too much money for it to be insured at a bank or a credit union. They have so much money. But is it really that much less of a risk to put your money in a credit union that would go to communities and loan that the credit union would loan that out to communities? And having that base of money, it would be less likely that the credit unions and banks would fail because they have that money in reserve from the endowment. But also, if we stopped going to war, those investments that they have in war would not be good investments. And if we stopped people from exploiting people, those investments that they have that are about exploiting people would not be profitable investments. So if I was a donor, and donors, they want that money maintained. They want the endowment maintained. They don't necessarily want the endowment to make money. And it's only Phil Knight and his minions, I suspect, that want the endowment to make money.
Greetings, everyone. My name is Dr. Gordon, and I'm a clinical psychologist. You may have seen me speak at the first student rally months ago, or at several other actions since October. Early on, when our rallies were still small, it was important to me that people saw anti-Zionist Jews like me speaking out against colonization and genocide. Since then, with the hard work of comrades in this crowd, I'm proud to say that our movement has already achieved several victories at the local and state level, and I want to be sure that the students here know this. We convinced the Eugene City Council to pass a ceasefire resolution last year. We fought procedural interference and character assassination from Democratic Party operatives, and we successfully rewrote the local party platform to include anti-genocide, anti-apartheid, ceasefire, and divestment policies with overwhelming support from the rank and file. That's right. Yeah. What I've learned is that victory is possible, but there won't be any easy wins. I'm telling you this because I wrote a draft divestment resolution for the city of Eugene and organized a campaign with a working group from the Springfield Eugene Anti-Imperialist Coalition. Yeah, give them a round of applause. They've been behind a lot of stuff here. Thanks to the efforts of that working group, we received endorsements from many community groups, including SJP. We presented the divestment resolution to City Council on April 8th with incredible testimonies during public comment. We had the choir show up. I suggest you go back and watch the YouTube video. The city is now researching the possibility of updating their investment policy based on our recommendations. There are no guarantees, but it was the first step. So, I believe if you can succeed with the divestment efforts at the University of Oregon, that momentum will carry over into actual changes in city policy. The fight is about to get uglier, but the people of Eugene and the people of Gaza are counting on you to win. So remember this. It is not those who can inflict the most, but those who can endure the most who will conquer.
Yeah.
Now, one more thing. Repeat after me. In our thousands, in our millions, we are all Palestinians. In our thousands, in our millions, we are all Palestinians. In our thousands, in our millions, we are all Palestinians. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I wanted to, on the topic of divestment really quickly, I think our University of Oregon Faculty and Staff for Justice in Palestine, newly formed, has identified something on our campus, and that's that we already have a divestment campaign on campus. We already have a plan and a policy on ethical investment, right? Ethical investment policy. So for us, we have a plan, our campus has a plan already to divest from fossil fuels, and that's great, right? Round of applause. Great. So then when this encampment has been met with the claim that divestment is performative, we reject that. We reject that because we are already divesting, right? So for us, the issue of ethical investment should extend to weapons manufacturers, right? Yeah. Thank you. Jason, faculty member Jason, is going to speak with us now. Thank you.
You're fine, Kaylee. Kaylee has a lot on her plate and has been working tirelessly for this movement.
Thank you, Kaylee.
Thank you, Kaylee. My name is Jason Sides. I'm an instructor at the Knight Campus graduate internship program in bioinformatics. And tonight I'll be reading a poem I'm sure most, if not all of you, have read at this point. I may have to pause at moments. The poem is If I Must Die by Rifat al-Riha, who was a Palestinian writer, poet, activist, and professor. He taught literature and creative writing at the now destroyed Islamic University of Gaza. He also co-founded the organization We Are Not Numbers, which provides English language writing workshops for young Palestinian aspiring writers in Gaza, matching them with experienced authors. On December 6th, he and his brother, his sister, and four of his nephews were killed by the State of Israel, deliberately targeted, their apartment surgically bombed out of the entire building where it's located, according to corroborated eyewitnesses and family accounts. If I must Die by Rifat al-Riha. If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings, make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze, and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself, sees the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment an angel is there, bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope, let it be a tale.
You already kind of went into this, but something I really wanted to talk more about is the imprint of the George Floyd uprising on your text. Michelle wrote, you've written extensively about these topics beforehand, but there are two really wonderful essays published in 2019 and 2020 in Pinko and Endnotes on family abolition. It seems that the George Floyd uprising is one of the huge kind of developments that's happened since those publications. So I wonder if you could speak a little bit to, how how that impacted your writing process, your thought process for this project.
Yeah, the element I spoke to is probably the biggest one, this sort of element of utopian thought tied up with the rebellion. I also, you know, people often sort of turn to this book sort of looking for a program, and I do have reform proposals and organizing ideas that I hope are helpful to people. But the George Floyd Rebellion helped to really concretize and confirm an idea that I've had for a while. So I've been in social movements for 25 years or so, and worked as a professional organizer during many of those years, and was a campaign director in a big housing struggle in New York City, and have been in and out of radical circles where we sort of, to varying degrees, thought of ourselves as like cadre of a revolutionary movement in Maoist and anarchist and other political organizing circles. And one of the things that led me sort of out of those political traditions and more towards what in this book I engage, I call, or is known as communization theory, and we can talk more about that, is that the dynamics of rebellions as they unfold in the world right now, I think organizers have to really rethink our position in them. That I did not see in the huge constellation of nonprofits, radical collectives, organizing groups in New York City, people managing to figure out how to engage this rebellion successfully in a way that was actually helpful to people. And part of that were certain nonprofits who, you know, drew a really clear line between what they called nonviolent protests, where police beat people up, and what they called violent protests, where people broke windows or blocked highways. But part of that also was that the whole idea of the position of the organizer and the mass, we might say, is one that I think it has really been in crisis for a long period of time now. That organizers work very hard to get a campaign going, and we might do it, we mostly lose, occasionally we don't. And then meanwhile, every once in a while, things go crazy, right? The sort of world is turned upside down for a moment. And why it happens, when it happens, and what our role in it is in it are like really open, difficult questions. And that, for me, that is a real invitation for trying to do theory differently and trying to be more creative and bold and expansive in how we theorize. That if we don't know what the relationship is between theory and action, then maybe we should become a little looser and expansive in being open to new and different ideas and trying to do that. And then also, thinking about white supremacy and organizing around racial injustice has certainly been an important part of my politics for a long time and is present throughout the Endnotes book. There's a lot on sharecropping and slavery and whatnot. But I tried in writing this, I was writing Endnotes as has been mostly a white communist theory space in many ways, and comes out of a kind of French European Marxist tradition that I think has been very, very bad in engaging white supremacy seriously. And I tried to sort of rewrite a lot of that material and take the racial capitalism, the racial piece very, very seriously, really recognizing how the history of the family that I cover in part one over the last 200 years, really thinking about the rise and fall of the working class family as the site of any degree of respectability or stability for anyone from the late 19th century into the 1970s and the rebellions both before and after then, really recognizing that this was centrally a question about race. Like whose family, who was able to form a stable family, whose family counted, and how the very conception of family became an organizing principle of society had everything to do with the history of settler colonialism and slavery, and the enlisting, the buying off of a section of the working class into the project of racial capitalism. And so trying to locate that very centrally. And I think that the rebellion certainly helped it develop my thinking in that and recognition in that. And I think was really very helpful in shaking people up.
One of the things that you write about in the book that I found very relatable is the kind of melancholy that happens between these moments of insurrection and the sense of responsibility you have towards, you say, is maintaining and developing some of these insights that come up during these kind of revolutionary bursts of energy. How do we hold on to those when everything in life is pushing us away from them? So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what that's like, right? maybe as an everyday practice, maybe as a writer, as a thinker, but I found that very inspiring.
It sounds like perhaps you might have a little bit more to say.
Well, I loved when I found out that you and your friend were writing a novel together, and it seemed to me that that was buoying you, feeding your imagination, preserving some of these questions and insights, allowing you to do something with them. I don't know if there's something that you have to impart to all of us, because I think that's something that anyone who's ever been in a social movement has had to reckon with, this this period afterward, however you characterize it, maybe not melancholy. That's how I experience it.
Yeah, I don't really know.
Well, you seem to.
Perhaps. So I, like, one of the things that people very quickly imagine family abolition as being about is forming rural communes or collective housing situations, right? Collective living situations right now, right? Going out and trying to do that. And that, I think that's an example of people that you know, there's, the history of them is complicated, but they certainly have helped spread and proliferate when there are broader rebellions that people are a part of. You know, people have an experience in the streets and then they try to figure out how to institutionalize it, how to make it into their living situation. And there's a lot to be said for that. I think that the sort of history of that, there's some great beauty in it, great inspiration in it. And it's mostly failure, and often it's a horrible failure. Often the situations can be very bad that people find themselves in. I lived in group housing situations for a while, and you know, I learned a lot from them, and we're very grateful for them. And similarly, you know, have a somewhat unconventional parenting and family structure in some ways right now. And that comes out of sort of trying to figure out how to carry the sort of spirit of collective life into reproducing our day-to-day lives. And I think part of the point that I try to make in this book is that it's that the main reason people form nuclear families is not because of internalized ideology about what you should do, although that has an enormous weight on people, certainly, but it's actually a survival strategy within the dynamics of racial capitalism, labor markets, and state policy, right? Like, you form a group housing situation, and then someone gets sick, or someone has a kid, or someone gets old, or someone needs to take a job somewhere, and who moves with them, right? Like, the dynamics of the world we live in make it very, very difficult to sustain any households, but non-nuclear households are way harder, right? That they fragment as people try to navigate getting by in the world. And that the kind of support systems that we have available make it very difficult to sustain anything besides a nuclear family. And I think that's true in general, right? Not just on the axis of family, that we encounter something incredible in the streets, in moments of rebellion, in strikes, in moments where we're joining in something, and we glimpse a totally different kind of world. And that world might shape our career decisions for the rest of our lives. It might lead us to write poetry or make art. It might lead us to write communist theory. It might lead us to be, hopefully, way less assholes to our friends and coworkers and neighbors, you know? It might lead us to try to live what we hope are ethical lives, and as it should. And all the practices that we can do to foster that, to facilitate that, to encourage that, I think are worth doing. And recognizing that there are structural determinants around so many of the life decisions we make. And when we try to make other decisions, the conditions that allow us to do so erode out from under us. They're hard to hold on to. And recognizing that as a structural process, as a structural set of forces that exceed us as individuals, and recognizing that we cannot make the revolution in small groups of people. We cannot make it within our home. We can do our best, and we can become better people, and we can become hopefully slightly more creative and open-hearted people in that process, but that we have to actually change the structural material conditions that lead everybody to form nuclear households, and that is the task before us, and that clearly requires more than a nuclear household. It requires more than everyone in this room. And that's a question that we have to be asking ourselves all the time, over and over again. And if we end up not being able to hold on to that spark that we saw out there, that's an experience that many generations of people have had before us.
I think I have one more question, which is inspired by a recent conversation. I invited Michelle onto a podcast that I co-host that's about broadly about questions of genre having to do with TV and film, and it was actually a really fun excuse for us to talk Star Trek. One of the things that we were kind of opening up in that conversation was just your personal experiences, you know, thinking through family evolution, maybe not recognizing it as such yet, right? So I wonder if you could share just your own story with this discourse, how you came to recognize yourself as a family abolitionist, what maybe some core experiences were in that. You don't need to talk about Star Trek, but.
Maybe we should just talk about Star Trek. So I came to the idea of family abolition quite late and came to it as an imminent process. I edited, was one of the lead editor of a number of people on a reader of revolutionary feminist writing, mostly out of anti-capitalist struggles. And I edited all these different essays by people at different moments of struggle in the 19th and 20th century who were talking about the family as that which they needed to overcome. And it was very striking because it became clear to me that they broadly agreed ethically. They were part of overlapping traditions, and yet what they meant by family kept totally changing, right? So Marx and Engels are capitalism has already abolished the working class family. We need to go after the bourgeois one. And then Alexander Kollontai was the level of injustice in working class households. We need to have communism so that women aren't stuck at home cleaning and instead can fully join the revolution. And it's not immediately obvious that they are defining family in completely antithetical ways. The two of them, right? Just 60 years apart, at both Marxists, right? Or who knows what Marxists. But so I sort of engaged in this project of tracing the unfolding meanings of family in these struggles to go beyond it, and managed to map those onto a certain argument about the changing role of the working class family in capitalist reproduction. And so that becomes part one of the book, sort of tracing the changing meanings of family from the 1840s into now, and the changing meanings of struggles to go beyond the family onto changes in capital accumulation and the place of the family as a unit of working class reproduction. And obviously I could go into that argument at great length. It's a difficult one to summarize succinctly. But that, I sort of began to realize that the family was the core conceptual thread that tied together, that like thinking about gay liberation, thinking about women's liberation, thinking about the transformation of gender and sexual roles in society, there are a lot of ways of going about it. And I began to recognize the family as a sort of synthetic intersection of all these different unfolding dynamics and a way of mapping, understanding changing queer and gender politics, the changing sexual and gender politics onto the history of capitalism. So I found it very analytically helpful. And that's what led me to write my first essay on it. And I came to sort of the political conclusion slowly, just over the course of the last 10 years. Like, I've been a radical for a long time, but it's really just since like 2019 I began to be like, well, I actually think this politically makes sense. Like, I arrived at it quite late. But then when I did that, right, and you've been writing in this vein for a while, a few people have, when I came to that, when I sort of thought about it this way, I was able to retroactively see, you know, sort of after the fact, being drawn to different kinds of utopian imaginaries that included some element of collective life beyond the nuclear family. And one of those was my adolescent obsession with Star Trek. And this like fantasy of not only getting to travel to distant stars or whatnot, but like these people live with their friends. It's kind of amazing. They're on outer space communes, right? That are communists, they are socialists, they are beyond money, they are utopian in various ways, but they like live with people that they collaborate with, that they care about, that they work with, right? And something about that was just incredibly compelling to me. Grew up here in Eugene, Oregon. This is where I'm from, and I was a very, very sad adolescent. I was a very sad kid. I'm trans, so I was a sad boy and not very good at it. And it didn't really work for me very well, you know? And it took being a part of many, many social movements and changing my gender and a lot of other things to like find my way out of that despair. And Star Trek, as you know, these flying space communes was an inspiration in that. And then new Star Trek shows come out every week now, so it's just a great time to be alive. I wanted to ask you, Madeline, so you alluded to the difficulties of writing about this topic, and you've alluded to me a number of times about the complexity and density of the question of parenting, mothering, and thinking about family abolition. And you have written more deeply and more thoughtfully about children's liberation than I have. And I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about motherhood and childhood and how you've grappled with these topics.
Yeah, I want to promote an essay that just came out by Max Fox, who's a collaborator of mine. He wrote The Traffic of Children for Parapraxis, yeah, for which Michelle is an editor. And more recently for Lux Magazine, he wrote an essay called Free the Children. He actually interviewed me. Another instance where I was gonna co-author something and then I was just like, well, why don't you just interview me? I don't really know how to, I do struggle with how to write directly towards these issues and find myself writing around them more. But one of the central questions that we've been thinking about is how does one parent without outside of a property relation, right? And it is impossible for all the reasons that You just brought up these things are individually insurmountable, right? I'm waiting for a revolution to happen so that I can relate to my child outside of property. And that's insufficient. My kid is growing up. And there's a sense of urgency in parenting. You're watching something slip away day by day. And it's frustrating. It's very, it's confusing. So I have been thinking a lot about this in terms of critical utopianism, which is a kind of, it's a branch of utopian thought that a scholar named Tom Moylan really cites as like coming out of the 70s with sci-fi writers like Ursula K. Le Guin, Octavia Butler, who are writing from a place of imminence, right? So utopia is not a blueprint, is not a method, or is that, excuse me, not a blueprint or a program, it's more of a methodology, a way of thinking, a way of seeing that reckons with failure, that reckons with that sense of impossibility. The melancholy and despair that come with that, that I want to have a different kind of relationship to my child. And we live under capitalism, and I cannot. what am I to do with that? Am I to resign to it? And certainly any parent does in moments of the day, resign to that sense of failure and impossibility. Do I struggle with it? How do I struggle with it in ways that aren't just about our individual relationship? How do I struggle with it in ways that can move beyond into a kind of collective shape in some way? So those are some of the kind of questions that I have worked through. And so I have, in writing about kind of a critical utopian motherhood or something like this, I have tended towards these other genres that are more speculative, that are more imprecise, that that are poetic, that are epistolary, that allow me, I guess, to inhabit this sense of imprecision and frustration, but in a way that I find also generative and inspiring. So how to, in other words, like work from that feeling of failure and impossibility towards a sense of revolutionary possibility, right? So even now I'm like, man, you don't really have good words for this, and maybe you're proving your point.
It's hard to talk about.
It is really hard to talk about, and so I've a number of times since 2017 sat down to write a version of a book, and instead I ended up writing a book of poetry. Instead I wrote an essay, or instead I get interviewed for something or something like this. It's frustrating. I don't know if I'll ever overcome it, but that's okay with me. This is part of why I think your book is a great resource for us. But I've found personally that being able to sit with those frustrations and sit with that sense of individuated failure to be quite profound and illuminating in terms of what I think my desires are, right? I really appreciate your point of what is the limitation. I also come from a Marxist feminist background, and that is a problem that Marxism needs to reckon with, or maybe it's just a reason why we should move beyond Marxism in certain ways, right? Is that there isn't really a way to account for desire or engage with our dreams or imagination, or move towards visioning, however imperfect, however speculative, however incomplete, to make use of these kinds of glimmers that we get from insurrection and build from them. So I find that also a frustrating thing about political theory, right, is that you write a piece of political theory, this is supposed to be comprehensive. I'm hearing one of the things you're saying is people are taking this to be a program, right? They're interpreting it as that. And I see that in within the text, you're struggling against that almost inevitable kind of readership, you know, that political theory incites. But that hasn't been the genre I've wanted to inhabit with these questions.
So I wanted to invite Loa to ask the first question or two, and then we're opening it up for the audience.
Cool. Yeah. Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. I will just briefly, since Star Trek got brought up, canonically, the Federation is founded out of a successful global Trotskyist revolution. So just lore note, just fun. I've got so many places I could go with questions, but the one that I'm going to go to, I think, is specifically kind of addressing the idea of abolition. And the book, particularly in the third part, does a lot of addressing why various people have sort of like refused to, like either said that it's bad or that they're not personally willing to do the speculation beyond abolition, beyond the revolutionary moment. And it was making me think of something that happened recently in Eugene, which was the Healing Not Handcuffs campaign, which is there was a levy to put more money into the jail, fuck the jail. And the way that the campaign was largely structured was that it was like, hey, like actually instead of police, instead of the jail, we should have, you know, social services, we should have, there should be housing, there should be mental health care and everything. There's something about it that doesn't like work for me where I don't link those together. I don't think that instead of police, we should have social workers. I think that change should be provided for people, but I think that we get trapped into a model where when things become replacements for what they are right now, when abolition becomes about transformation, instead of being like, no, bad thing, bad, get rid of it, and these other things are other conversations, that we end up with things like, okay, now there's social workers who are, you know, tracking people, or we get the abolition, like the Reagan closing down of, you know, institutionalized mental health care, which, like, institutions were bad, but then it becomes, okay, it's in-home, but like with massive encroachments of like now surveillance that replaces that. And I think I'm wondering if you have an inclination towards the idea where I have a hesitancy towards the idea of not towards speculation, but linking speculation specifically to abolition. And that I don't think that that's what historically the people you're addressing are doing. I don't think that they're rejecting speculation I think they're saying, okay, we want to abolish this, but I can't speculate. Yeah. But I think that there's, at least for me, something that is, no, speculation is good, but linking it to abolition chains it to the particular forms that are here now, and restricts the speculation, and sort of like recontextualize speculation where we're trying to put things into particular, like, you know, puzzle pieces that are missing.
Right. I think you said it better than I could, and I think that was very coherent and helpful. A few thoughts related to this. One is so many social institutions are actually forms of tremendous horrific violence and brutality and injustice, but they're also means of addressing actually existing social problems in a way that is compatible with profit accumulation in the overall dynamics of society, right, on some level. And we can offer better solutions, but those better solutions, recognizing that how much they kind of bear the print of the world that we live in. So the idea of replacing police with social workers is about imagining social workers as the means of managing large surplus populations of poor people that society has cast out, right, are not absorbed into productive work very easily, or really a marginal win of wage labor that funds, that enables a system of low-cost services, of food delivery and lots of other things that we rely on, and that this is a much broader generalized problem, right, of what the place of poor people is, the survival of poor people, that has deep structural conditions, and a certain amount of unmanageability is really built into it, and perhaps even politically necessary for change. And but the question becomes, how will you keep these people contained? What will you do to make sure these people don't get out of hand? Right, and the left steps up and been like, well, we will replace police with social workers, and social workers will keep them contained. Social workers will control them. Social workers will keep them from killing you, right? And that's what the left becomes in the process, rather than actually being able to talk about structural solutions, rather than actually being able to raise questions about why there are so many poor people, and can poor people be agents in a social transformation that as a link of a much broader struggle of the multiracial working class. And so that's, I'm trained as a social worker, I worked in aid services for a long time, and there's no question that social work is really dominated by carceral impulses, by dynamics of what it takes to control and discipline poor people. And the history of social work is very tied up with that, you know, of wealthy bourgeois ladies who would visit poor people's homes and tell them how they should live, right? That was a huge part of it. And so there's, you know, a long history of kind of social control. And the history of the family, like one of those things the bourgeois ladies did is try to teach working class people how to live like them in their family structures and in their family decision making. And, you know, of course, visiting bourgeois ladies don't have that much impact. It took some much broader social forces to unfold for working class people to be able to form families. But these kind of structural questions, I think we have to ask ourselves over and over again. And one of another piece of this is we have a new book, Pinko has a new book out called After Accountability that you can pre-order. It's on a crate in the Pacific right now. And I wrote a closing essay in it talking about abolition and community, ideas of community that are related to the conclusion of this book. And one of the things that I say is when prison and police abolitionists talk a lot about community-based solutions, they are misreading some key things that police and prisons are for, which is the defense of property. And of course, police and prison abolitionists know this, but like the police are a fairly modern institution. Ingalls talks about special armed gangs of men as an integral part of class society. That as long as there has been property, private property as a social form, there have been groups of armed people defending it. And that is a really major part of class history. And that if we want to drastically reduce the role of police in our society, we have to drastically transform the place of private property, like what it means to be poor or not. And I think that's something that a lot of people know and surprisingly don't say that often. It connects to a lot of other things, but do you have some thoughts about this?
I want to hear more questions on this.
Okay, so let's open it up for the audience. If it goes, sure.
Yeah. So both of you have spoken about revolution, not a lot, but a little bit, and I just wonder exactly what you mean by that, because when I think of revolution, I think of a violent overturning of the political order replaced by something wonderful for a brief time, which is then taken over itself by forces that are repressive in a different way. So I wonder, where are you going with this notion of revolution when you speak of it?
I think if there's any hope for humanity at all, or the vast majority of species on this earth, we have to get out of class society. We have to get out of a system where capitalist profit is the governing fundamental principle of how we allocate the vast majority of social resources and human time and human ingenuity and creativity. You can think whatever you want, and we can talk about it, but we have to get out of that. And I don't think there's any way of getting out of that without crushing the capitalist state and having a global armed rebellion, among other things. That the dynamics of private property, that states are built to defend them and built to reproduce them, and that that's been true for a very long time. And that what it will take to form a global revolutionary movement capable of crushing the capitalist state and overcoming private property is a very good question. And I think we are in a crisis where existing scripted models of what revolution should look like or could look like clearly don't work. And frankly, scripted clear models of how to get reform or even a marginally less horrific society also don't really seem to work, right? Reforms happen sometimes, but there was a political era, I think, when a lot of people could connect to an idea of how social change actually functioned, and that right now we're in a moment where we really don't know, where there's a deep level of uncertainty about how to proceed, about how to get anything decent at all. And that's real, that's totally real. And I don't have the answers to that, right? I mean, I have been influenced by different revolutionary traditions that have sort of clear accounts of this, and I don't particularly have a clear, confident idea. The revolutionary tradition that I engage in this book the most, well, I engage a lot of traditions, but the set of ideas I engage repeatedly is communization, a very obscure post-1968 French communist tradition. And it really is interested in what actually happens during uprisings, not what kind of institutions, if there was enough political will, could be created out of an insurgency, but really looking at the insurgency itself, the experience people actually have during riots or occupations or big strikes, and the forms of governance that emerge during them, the forms of problems that people have to overcome, and the types of thinking about what a free society could be that emerge during periods of insurgency, and trying to learn from those, trying to extrapolate from those, trying to imagine from those, and recognizing how different models of socialism or different models of change throughout history have reflected particular kinds of experiences of work and its overcoming. And so it's a theoretical question that is deeply, deeply unanswered. And I think we're living in an era where it is more unanswered than ever. And it's a question that we have to be asking ourselves over and over again and trying to think beyond. In the novel, we tried to propose a revolution, a scenario where a revolution was possible, and involved the catastrophic and horrific collapse of capitalist trade as a functional system of survival. Right? Involves a level of crisis where the capitalist state is no longer able to care for anyone. And what could emerge out of that, right? And that's not something I wish on our world, right? If we came up with a better idea, I'm all for it.
Well, the only thing I want to add to that, which I think is lovely about the third part of this book, is what I heard you saying is revolution is a violent overthrow. It leads to something briefly beautiful and hopeful that will inevitably be overtaken by counter-revolutionary forces. And I think that sense of inevitability is shared among most of us. It's largely what prevents us from actually really thinking deeply about revolutionary possibility. And it's a strong case to speculate, which I think I would say not the bulk of the third part of the book, but a lot of the revolutionary visioning that Michelle is doing in the third part of the book is also anticipating counter-revolutionary forces and thinking through different contingencies, and that counter-revolution is, you know, absolutely an obstacle in thinking revolution, but absolutely not a reason not to think it, right? So that's the only thing I'd add to that. But that sense of inevitability, I would say, is something that we mutually question. Earlier versions of that were, you know, Cold War fear of totalitarianism or things like that, that would, it would have to lead in that direction. And I think that that's something that, you know, this text is not afraid of reckoning with those kind of dystopian apocalyptic crises that will probably emerge in these kinds of scenarios, but that they require these kinds of speculative tools, these imaginative thought experiments, and these type of things to prepare us collectively. So it's an imperfect answer, but I think to rest on the questions and not a sense of certainty or prediction, right? I think prediction is a very different thing than speculation in this sense too. So I don't know if that's sufficient.
Thank you. So last one in line, this one, perspective.